Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of Rings and Rituals, Adrift, from the Payne and McKay series, Rings of Power. I'm Marilyn, the librarian of Rivendell.
And I'm Sarah, Shield Maiden of Rohan. And we're delighted that you've joined us. Today, we'll be reviewing what we mean by ritual, and then applying those concepts to different examples of ritual that we find in this second episode of the TV series. We'll explore them using a set of questions to reveal how Payne and McKay depicted the cultures that they were adapting to their series.
Be sure to get in touch with us. A discussion of two is an adventure, but we'd love to have more voices join us. You can email us at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com, and or you can join our Rings and Rituals channel on the Lorehounds Discord. We'll include all that information in the show notes.
And we also want to say that we are a proud affiliate of the Lorehounds Barovian Broadcasting Network, where you'll find all sorts of interesting podcasts on TV, films, books, video games, and other stories. Our thanks to all the listeners who support the Lorehounds through good ratings on Apple iTunes, joining the Lorehounds Patreon, and other forms of donation. If you like what we're doing here, consider giving them a boost as well. Okay, so before we get into it, let's review our process. Firstly, Marilyn, what do we mean by ritual?
Yes, ritual is a repeated action, first of all. It's usually intended to recognize and or bring about change in some fashion. It often has symbolic content, but not always. Brushing your teeth morning and evening could be considered a ritual. It may be a form of making meaning, which does not have to be religious or spiritual. And it may create or reinforce community identity, although it can also be a private ritual.
And we'll keep those points in mind as we describe each ritual and then ask some of the following questions. What is the design of the ritual? What is the intent of the ritual? What is the outcome? And particularly, what does it tell us about the culture and the individuals in that culture?
So before we get into all that, we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll bring you the meat or the tofu for our vegan or vegetarian listeners without the quail sauce.
Welcome back. We're going to review the ritual elements that we saw in this episode, but to aid our listeners' memories, we'll begin each section with a synopsis of events. Now please note, we are doing full-on spoilers throughout these episodes. If that isn't what you want, go and binge the entire season and then come back and join us.
Yes, please, come back and join us. So, for the first time in this episode, we see the magnificent opening sequence images, and here the music of Howard Shore. This is the one time that we'll hear Howard Shore as composer, although I must say I think Bear McCreary is doing a perfectly fine job.
Oh, I totally agree.
It was really stunning to see the sand, or what looked like sand, shaping and reforming. And
Absolutely wonderful and so cleverly done. Because I know I've spoken to the folks behind that opening sequence.
Yes.
And it's an incredible thing that they did. I mean, it's not done by AI. It's done by actual sand resonating to actual sound. And it's just stunning.
And the fact that it is music sound that generates all these shifting patterns ties right back into the very beginning of the Silmarillion and the Aina Lindule. So it's the more people looked at it, they said, wow, this is amazing. And at first it was like, what is this supposed to be? But you know, slowly the symbols and the images started to make sense.
And, right. Yes. And I think the more you think about it, the more you realize that actually this is incredibly appropriate for this sort of story, to have a world shaped through sound in this way.
Absolutely. So, surprised to realize that she feels responsible for the stranger's well-being, Nori helps him with the reluctant assistance of Poppy. Back in the Harfoot camp, Sadok is wondering about the starfall, while Marva and Marigold are wondering whether they should break camp right away or wait until after the festival. Sadok says perhaps they're safer in camp than out, but that they should all be keeping an eye out because the starfall does not bode well.
Well, it's always lovely to hang out with the Harfoots.
Yes, yes, definitely.
So there's a wonderful kind of what we could call a cultural affirmation that we hear amongst the Harfoots, and we start to hear this now, and it will continue throughout the series. It's this chant or statement that they use frequently. Nobody goes off trail and nobody walks alone. It's used as a saying, but it's also used as like a chant with a rhythm to it, which you could walk to, which is really appropriate.
Which is what they spend an awful lot of their time doing.
Absolutely. So the bit with Malva and the sisters, they seem to me quite important in the sense that they, along with Sadok, are the ones who affirm the practices of the group. This is what we do. This is how we do it. And we all do it this way. Mm-hmm. And they maintain those community norms. And I think that's really important for the Harfoots, because everything that they do is about remaining together as a community, which is all about survival, right? Especially when you're itinerant, as they are.
Yes. And I love that we have a very iconic image of it's the old women who keep the knowledge, who keep the wisdom,
right?
Keep the young ones in line. Not that the young ones really like that a whole lot or pay very close attention.
Especially not Nori.
Especially not Nori. But for those of you who are Star Wars fans, this may bring up a familiar expression too. This is the way. Mm. Which could certainly fit for the Wayfinder, Sadok. That is sort of the way this phrase functions in a ritual fashion. It's kind of a stripped down thing, but definitely indicative of their culture, which seems to expect a certain level of conformity.
Oh, definitely. That idea of nobody goes off trail is we stick together. This is how we do it. Nobody goes off by themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's all fine and good until you get to Nori. Because Nori wants to go off trail. Nobody wants her to do that, but she wants to be outside of the norm because she wants to see what else is out there. Mm-hmm. And that is not what the Harfoots do. They have very set practices. We go from here to here at this time of the year. Mm-hmm. And we keep ourselves safe. I think Marigold actually says to her, you know, we keep each other safe. Because that's what we have to do. And the idea of someone going off and doing their own thing is so outside of their norm and their experience that it's kind of scary for Nori's parents. The idea that she just would go off and do something. That to me, I think Nori, having a Nori actually teaches us more about the Harfoots because she stands in such opposition to them.
Definitely, definitely. Yes, rugged individualism not welcome here.
And they are, I think, incredibly strict about sticking to the rules. Their rules are extant. These are the rules. You stick to the rules. And nobody is happy if you don't stick to the rules.
And it is about the survival of the community. And I don't think a lot of us are accustomed to a culture that seems to, and I'll say seems to again, support the community over the individual.
That seems to is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence there, Marilyn, for good reason, right? As we'll come to later.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes.
I mean, you have, if you take it at face value, this is a really strict and stern culture. In actual practice, they threaten and so forth, but things do turn out rather differently from what this particular chant might suggest. So does that tell us anything particular about the Harfoot culture itself?
Well, I think it does. I think it tells us that they have these norms. These norms are strict to keep them safe. If anything happens outside of that, they will gather together those who are sticking to the norms, and anybody outside of that could be in trouble. And I think we get a hint of that when Nori's dad's leg is injured.
Yes.
Towards the end of the episode. Because the first question that Sadok asks is not, is he okay? It's, can you migrate?
How soon can you travel? Yes.
Yep. That's it. And I think that tells us quite a bit about them. And there was a lot of discussion at the time about, you know, does this make the Harfoots kind of brutal? Or is this just simply what the culture is like because they have to be? Yeah. It's a balance, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And we'll see a lot more about that very question in an episode or two when we come to a just amazing ritual.
And I think when we come to that, we get to learn what it really means if somebody is on their own outside of the group and what can happen. So anything else on the Harfoots, Marilyn?
Not for now, I don't think, but it's nice to have this little peek in.
It sets us up for later discussion, doesn't it?
Exactly, exactly. And keeping that phrase in the back of your mind can be very helpful as you watch the Harfoots in action or inaction.
Indeed.
So.
Okay, do you want to move us to the next one then?
Yes, indeed. In the Southlands, Branwen and Arondir look at the remains of Harden, with fissures in the ground and no bodies left behind. They separate, Arondir to explore a tunnel and Branwen to warn her people. In Eregion, Celebrimbor explains to Elrond that he has a new project in mind that might even exceed the Silmarils and embody what he calls real power. Celebrimbor tells us true creation requires sacrifice. He also says, I admire all who can delve into the mystery of things, who can divine from the plainness of what is, the beauty of what could be. They will need a massive forge built before spring, and Elrond suggests inviting help from the dwarves. Now, I can't help but think, just as I was reading it just now, it occurred to me, Celebrimbor sees what is as plain.
Yes, that struck me as well.
And he wants to make it what he considers to be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound elvish to you?
The elves tend to appreciate the beauty in what's around them, the natural world around them.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds Feanorian rather than general elvish, don't you think?
Excellent connection. My first thought answering my own question was, this sounds very Noldorin.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Feanor was a Noldor, so...
Yes, it's kind of that idea of superiority over things. When you want to make them better, which assumes that they're not good in the first place.
Exactly, exactly. Which may also speak to why the Noldor decided to migrate in the first place.
Right.
There were so many elves who said, you know, it's beautiful here. This is Cui Vienen. You know, there's all these wonderful things to look at and appreciate. Why should we go anywhere else? We're perfectly happy where we are. So I think the Teleri came closest to that.
Mm.
They wanted to stay by the sea and sail their boats and appreciate what Ose and Uinen and Ulmo had to say to them. But the Noldor were definitely the craftspeople, the makers. Mm-hmm. And that is quite an ambiguous role in Tolkien's world.
Mm.
It's perilous, let us say. There's a very fine line that one has to walk in order not to usurp someone else's authority or exceed your own capacity. And Celebrimbor seems pretty driven here.
I think that we get all of the hints here that this attitude of Celebrimbor is what's going to get him into trouble. Spoiler alert.
Yes.
I won't reveal the entire spoiler. But saying something like true creation requires sacrifice, that immediately raises the question of sacrifice of what or whom?
Mm-hmm.
You know, does it really always? And what does he mean by true creation?
Yeah,
it's just interesting to pull the language apart. Then when he says, I admire all who can delve into the mystery of things. Well, we know of somebody who is able to delve into the mystery of things who really you should not be admiring.
Not
but
too much,
he does,
no.
And that's going to create trouble.
So. And the fact that he has, however, accomplished Feanor's hammer. Now, I don't think any Noldor can ever forget Feanor, but do we really want to commemorate him?
Yeah. I mean, Celebrimbor, as we know, is extremely closely related to Feanor.
Grandson.
And would have known very well what had happened with Feanor and his sons.
Yeah,
you'd think that would be, oh, here's a lesson I should be learning. But rather, he seeks to emulate him.
Or exceed him.
Yeah.
I think that's the real driver here.
And that's a problem.
He does say.
That's
definitely. Exceeding this, as in some version, potentially the second worst being. Maybe third worst. We have to put Sauron in there too, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, how do you want to exceed him? Why? And the fact that, you know, real power, that's the thing that makes me very uncomfortable too. Because that seems to imply a level of power that, again, could really lead to a lot of trouble.
Right. Yeah. Because real power implies that there's power that just isn't enough.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing how much we can deduce about his character from just a few simple quotes.
Right. Now that the moment when Elrond and Celebrimbor arrive to go and visit the dwarves at Khazad-dûm is funny and rather wonderful, actually.
Yes.
But it does lead us to understand all sorts of things about the dwarves, because when Elrond approaches the door, he tells Celebrimbor what they should be able to expect.
Right.
And we can summarize it as being hospitality. Mm-hmm. He's talking about feasts and, you know, all sorts of things that are wonderful. And Celebrimbor looks like, you know, that sounds great. And then what do they get? A door slammed in their face. So it's quite a comedic moment. But it's important to note that hospitality seems to be an important thing for the dwarves, but it's also not compulsory.
Yes.
They can decide if they're going to offer it or not. And in this case, they are not offering it, mm-hmm. Which comes as a bit of a surprise to Elrond. But as he's going to learn, there is a reason why he's being denied entrance. Mm-hmm. So he then invokes the rite of Sigintarak, and a quite remarkable dwarvish ritual commences, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. The ritual of Sigintarag means the ritual of the Longbeards, which is the name of the clan who is settled now at Khazad-dûm. So, looking first at the music, because that's what I do, very rhythmic, very low. You can almost hear stomping and hammers banging on anvils. Just a single line of melody and very little harmonization. It's the sort of song that once it gets in your head, you have to work really hard to get it out. And there's string basses and other low instruments. Occasional voices, also very low. Single line, no harmonic stuff by and large. Brass instruments, lots of drums. But as far as we can tell at this point, no ram's horns, which was one of the things that Elrond said would be present at this wonderful welcome hospitality. And this rite is a very public affair.
Oh, yes. It's definitely not one that is done behind closed doors. You can see that everybody who's around is invited to come mm-hmm. and watch their prince
yes.
take on this skinny elf at a... It's not combat. It's like a fight against the stone, if you like, but it's a contest to see who has stamina and strength. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly very, very important. But let's actually talk about the beginning of the ritual first, mm-hmm. Because alongside all of that thrumming music underneath it all, we get the dwarves who are, you know, cheering and shouting in unison, and they're pumping their fists, and you can see both men and women mm-hmm. Amongst them, of lots of different ages and social stages. You can see ones who seem to be just, they're clearly minors, And they're dressed in very practical clothing. And then others who seem to be of a slightly higher social status with clothes that indicate that they're not literally getting their hands dirty in the the rock right now. And then we do hear the ram's horn.
Yes, we do.
But it's for a very particular reason, because it is there to greet not Elrond, no. Mm-mm. Prince Durin. Mm-hmm. And as he enters, and he enters with this wonderful kind of swagger.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. His cloak is swaggering.
Oh yeah. And the chants increase in tempo until Turin signals for a halt and invokes a call and response, mm-hmm. which is so clearly a part of the ritual. Yes. Khazad, doom. It's absolutely brilliant. So according to their beliefs, this ritual was actually fashioned by Aule himself, as Prince Durin announces, which again is clearly part of the ritual, where he speaks like, this is what the ritual is, and it's so ancient, it's been here with us since Aule himself. Mm-hmm. And it is a test of endurance. One after the other, each of them must smash a rock in turn. And we're not talking about like a small rock, we're talking about a boulder.
Yes.
And without pausing. And even if the axes get damaged, they have to get new ones. And the last one standing wins.
Yes. And the crowd loves this. Incredible level of mockery. And Durin himself is having a very sardonic attitude about it all and is just really enjoying, I think, Elrond's bewilderment initially and growing. I think he starts being pretty testy. It's like, what is this? Why do I have to? I mean, it's one thing I have to do the right to get your attention, but I have to endure all this other stuff as well. But that's part of the deal. That's part of the game, isn't it? It's like trash talking in a lot of different sports that we might see.
Oh yeah, it's like the WWF, the World Wrestling Federation stuff.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Stomping around, going, "Oh, that guy over there, he's such a weakling." It's a very similar sort of thing.
Does the elf understand?
And he's got this sneer on understand. His face as well. Oh.
It's just, he's just dripping with scorn and So with all the mockery going on and all the rest of it, it's a very lively, very noisy contest. And in the end, Elrond does yield. Now we see some interesting glances back and forth at the point of yielding, which we should keep in the back of our minds again for future episodes. He had smashed and broken his axe, and so they came to offer him another one. And there's this sense of, well, I shouldn't project too much because I already know what happened, but he's pretty annoyed at this point. I don't know if elves actually get pissed, but this is certainly the look that this is how I'm interpreting the look. And when he yields, the ram's horns sound again, and all the dwarves chant Durin's name, and it's like this immense uproar in a stadium somewhere. And I'll just put in a personal note here on this most recent rewatch on Amazon streaming. They, in their wisdom, threw in an advertisement from a locker room at this point, which absolutely encapsulated the vibe of the previous scene. It really was
appropriate.
Very funny. I'd love to think they did it on purpose, but I kind of doubt that that would be the case. So this is our introduction to the dwarves. We haven't seen anything about them yet. What do we see about their culture?
Well, clearly, strength and endurance are immensely important to them. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's connected to breaking rocks also shows that the strength and the endurance is linked to their relationship with the mountain, their relationship with the stone around them. Mm-hmm. And it's also... it's a ritual that is only for the royalty of the dwarves. So someone like Durin who has been challenged by somebody else. It doesn't seem to be a ritual that, Bob the dwarf can have a go at Nob the dwarf and say, right, we're going to do this. It seems to be actually much more important than that. So it's also a test of Durin as a prince, not just as a dwarf, but as a leader.
Sure.
Which makes it immensely important to him that he doesn't fail, because if he lost to the skinny elf, he's going to look really ridiculous. Yeah. I do interpret some of his looks across at Elrond as being ever so slightly concerned, just checking in to see how the elf is doing.
Interesting.
Yeah, because he cannot afford to lose in front of his people.
Right.
He would be made to feel weak.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
That's unacceptable. Elrond knows that. Of course Elrond knows that. And he would know that it would be... It's all very well that he's now got Durin's attention, but he would not want Durin to lose face in
Absolutely.
Front of his,
no.
his people.
That was never his intention, particularly given that he's coming to ask a favor.
Exactly.
But the personal aspect, I think, is even more important at this point for Elrond, because... Wow, he was not expecting this. And it was a maneuver on his part to invoke this right in the first place. I also rather think that, I mean, I don't know how they were able to have the news travel so quickly, but the minute that Durin knew who it was, there was no way he was going to let anyone else take this on.
Mm-hmm.
Both because of his hurt, the sadness and the anger that Elrond produced in him, which we'll be hearing about shortly, as well as the needing to demonstrate, his strength and his position and all of the things that you've been talking about. And I like that you say you think that he's also concerned for Elrond, because underneath all the hurt and the anger and the rest of it, there is still that connection. And as there would be, I mean, you don't get angry at somebody who disappears from your life if you don't care about them.
No. No, he's furious because he's hurt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And thought better of Elrond and so forth. But it's also a very interesting contrast between two cultures here. And again, we'll see that spelled out even more in the elevator speech coming right up.
Mm-hmm.
That... For the way the two cultures experience time is radically different. And this is the source of their misunderstanding and the unintentional hurt and so forth. So again, we see a contrast of cultures, which, I might say, dwarves live as long as they can, and they live large and they live hard and joyfully. I also like the fact that they mention Aule himself.
Yes.
Because here that it you could say this sacralizes the ritual. It was initiated by their father god, if you will, their
right.
creator. And that makes it of critical importance to them in who they are. What is it to be a dwarf? Although I don't know that they think that introspectively necessarily, but still, it's the first time we've seen any mention of a deity, as it were. Although they weren't really deities. They were more like demiurges.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that their demiurge, their creator, is so important to them, again, possibly because of their contrast to the other cultures in Middle Earth, it becomes all the more important to affirm this is who we are. In the same way with the Hardfoots, we heard this is who we are. With the chant that you hear so many times, or the admonition, depending upon how it's been developed.
Yeah, and far more so than we ever get from the elves or from the humans, this idea of this is who we are. It seems to be far more rooted in the Harfoots and in the dwarves.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's partly because I don't think... Well, the dwarves can be dominant species when they need to, but the Harfoots... definitely are not dominant species when it comes to other sentient beings.
And yeah, we're so, reminded of that, aren't we, when Nori sees the wolf track.
Print.
Yeah,
right.
And then we get to see the wolf. And I think we realize that actually the Harfoots can be very much in danger out in the world.
Oh, absolutely. And that's just one form.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so Elrond, having yielded the contest, manages to convince Durin to escort him to the surface. And during their elevator ride, he also convinces Durin of his remorse for his 20-year absence. That bit there where Durin tells him that he's missed his wedding, he's missed the birth of his children. Mm-hmm. And you can see this look of shock on Elrond's face, because 20 years to him is breathing in and out. That's it.
Yeah.
It's just nothing.
Yeah.
But so much has happened in Durin's life, and he's missed all of that, really important moments. You can see he is really sorry about it. I think it's actually quite a lesson for Elrond, this
absolutely.
Moment.
Absolutely. And it's a good example of I hate the notion of interspecies communication, but intercultural communication might be a better way to put it. There is genuine friendship between them, and yet there's also a responsibility on both sides to recognize, okay, if I want to demonstrate my affection for my friend, I need to be able to see the world through his eyes.
Yes.
More than I have been.
Yes.
You can't do it completely, but as someone who has been offered the gift of friendship by someone from a culture very different from your own, there's a certain amount of responsibility towards understanding what your friend would interpret as supportive or hurtful.
Yep. Yeah.
And, you know, time and the elves, it's almost like the air that they breathe or the water they swim in. And then this is the first time that Elrond has really encountered up close and personal, I think, what it is to be a mortal and not serially longevial.
Yes. Yeah. Like I said, quite the lesson for Elrond there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Durin brings Elrond to his home to apologize and then leave, apparently. But Disa, who is definitely in charge in that house and is respecting the tradition of the hospitality of the dwarves, she insists that he stay for dinner. And Elrond, of course, still hoping to remake his bond, perhaps, with Durin, or to, you know, mend the friendship. He gladly agrees to stay for dinner. And he spots the tree whose sapling he gave to Durin. Well, it must be more than 20 years ago, right? So,
yes.
Yes. It's alive and it's flourishing. It's growing in a place of great love. And you can see that actually Durin, and perhaps Disa as well, must have really worked hard to make sure that that sapling was in a place where it would get everything it needed.
Yes.
It clearly meant something to Durin. And even when he felt abandoned by Elrond, he didn't abandon the tree.
He didn't chop it down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Disa tells us how he cherished it like one of his children.
Right. Which kind of gives away the fact that Durin really does care about Elrond.
Just an inkling of a hint, yeah.
But the important thing for us, because we are talking about ritual, is that Disa describes to Elrond the craft and ritual of resonating, in which the dwarves who have the skill sing to the stone in such a way that the stone reveals to them its composition and its structure, and it allows the dwarves to decide where they're going to mine and what they have to leave alone. Mm-hmm. So it's a real connection to the rock, to the mountain, right?
Yeah. Yes, she actually describes it. And a few episodes from now, we will experience it. And wow, yeah. I can't wait for that. So we know it involves singing. So again, music, part of ritual. And it's not quite clear if it is for this particular function of mining. Is it just one person resonating or in groups? Because at one point it's expressed that Disa is particularly good at resonating. But she does talk about being with a group while it's happening. So maybe they're singing too. Maybe they're doing some particular mining tasks that they are particularly experienced or gifted at, but it could be a solitary activity, don't you think?
Yes, yeah. And not to preempt when we do see it later in the series, it is just Disa at that moment that is doing the resonating. But yeah, it could be a group of dwarves who are resonating at different frequencies, who are listening for different things in the stones. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I'd love to see more of it. That's what Definitely. I do know.
Definitely. And you used a very important word there, which is listening.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the noise and the hooting and the all that we went on in the previous ritual that we saw, this is a completely different approach. You're listening, you're recognizing that you need information and you want the information because you want to be able to do the best that you can. And so this cooperation with the mountain is quite different from the competition of the rite of Sigintaraq.
Oh, so yes, absolutely.
It's nice to know that the dwarves have both capacities, and particularly in what their fundamental activity is, which is mining and delving and shaping and forming the mountain. So they only proceed according to the information that they're given from the resonating. So I see it as being very communal and cooperative and even loving. Again, Celebrimbor has a very interesting quote. They sculpt the rock with the respect of one who cares for an aged parent.
Doesn't that connect beautifully with what Gimli says in The Lord of the Rings when they're talking about the glittering caves?
Yes.
And he said, you know, the dwarves wouldn't go in there with their pickaxes. Right. They would, you know, perhaps tap one tiny, tiny bit of stone in the course of an entire day.
Right.
And it would all be done with love and craft, because the dwarves really do have that connection to the stone world around them, if you
yes.
like.
Yes.
You know, they have a relationship there, because it's all very well resonating and singing to the stone, but the stone must permit itself to move. It must mm-hmm. agree. It has to, you know, allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. So there is a give and take between the dwarf and the rock that is
yes.
incredibly important.
And the dwarves have to respect what the rock and the mountain say.
Yes, because otherwise you could end up with a bunch of dead dwarves underneath a rockfall.
Right, right. Which leads me to leap ahead and wonder, what did they learn from the resonating that produced a certain aura that we'll mention at the very end here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, maybe a particular note comes back that tells them what's within the rock.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But also a caution about the rock surrounding it.
Yes.
You know, if the mountain tells you, hey, watch out, you know, my left elbow is hurting really bad right now. And they say, well, we'll just tap around it, you know, and maybe not a very good outcome.
Indeed. Yeah. So what can we summarize about what we know about the dwarves now then?
Well, I'm thinking about the contrast between their interactions with outsiders and their interactions with each other. Now, Elrond was not an outsider to Durin, even though he'd messed up somewhat in their friendship. But I just, on the surface, you know, we've been presented with this idea of dwarves as, you know, they're loud, they're smelly, they're gruff and rough and tumble, and they don't take nothing from nobody kind of thing. And then we hear that also they sing to their surroundings. They listen. They care. Durin cared for that symbol of the friendship. And even when he was seemingly ready to throw it out, still tended the symbol of it.
Yes.
And what it represented. Certainly the behavior we've seen between Disa and Durin is wonderfully loving and raucous and riotous and very cozy and cuddly.
Yes, it's a lovely relationship to see.
Yes, yes. And the fact that we can easily distinguish male from female dwarves, and they are partners, and just so many different things. The dwarves, I think, are very, very well characterized in this series, and quite a contrast, I think, to the source material.
Yes, yeah. And I'm thinking about them in contrast to the Harfoots. The Harfoots are connected to the natural world about them. Sadok looking at the stars and, you know, knowing what the land is going to give you at certain points in time and, you know, all the sorts of things that they do. They can even blend into the countryside, for goodness sake.
Yes.
Which is amazing. So they have a relationship with the natural world. So do the dwarves. It's just that their natural world is inside the earth rather than on the top of the earth.
Nice.
But they have just as powerful a connection with the living world around them because for them, rock is alive. It's not just, you know, dead stuff that you chip away at. It's something that they have a real relationship with.
And I also like that, again, in this envisioning of the dwarves, they're surrounded by plants in many places. You know, it was a tree that was the gift to Elrond. You know, they've set up all this incredible mirroring system to bring the sunlight down into the darkness so that they can grow greens, and so they don't have to worry about vitamin D deficiency if that's something that dwarves are concerned with. Maybe not. You know, they're supposed to be living underground most of the time. So there is that sense there, but yes, they certainly experience stone as being far more alive than any other culture I can think of.
Yes, I agree.
Middle Earth. So, and all the more juxtaposition then with the elves. Probably more so the Sylvan elves than the Noldor. I mean, we are told that the reason why the Noldor settled so close to Khazad-dûm at one point is because they were crafters. That was their fundamental cultural identity. You know, they crafted things with different materials and so forth. And early on, the elves who did listen had great profit from their friendship. So they were willing at some points to extend that hand of friendship and to give aid and also receive aid.
Right, right. Which shows that the dwarves are not, you know, isolated and keep themselves away from absolutely everybody. There is a connection there with outside forces.
For the time being.
Mm, I mean, for now.
Mm-hmm. We'll see. Right. We'll see.
Okay. Well, I think there are no more rituals that we've identified for the rest of this episode. Mm-hmm. But what we'll do is give you a quick synopsis of the remaining events just so you can keep up with the story for next time. Okay. So Nori returns to the stranger who develops a sudden taste for snails. Crunchy snails with the shells on.
Largo, calcium.
Sorry, Marilyn.
Calcium. Got to get that calcium.
Oh, got to get that calcium in, yes. Ugh. The vegetarian in me is going, ick. But anyway. Largo manages to injure his foot quite seriously by the look of it. Mm. Sadok and the wise women are even more concerned that they might not be able to start migrating on time.
Yes, this is definitely increasing the pressure.
Yes, it really is.
Then we go across the sea to where Galadriel has crossed the path of a raft full of Southlanders who are trying to escape the attention of a sea dragon that has wrecked their ship. At the reappearance of the worm, one Halbrand separates his part of the raft off from the others in the hopes that the worm will follow them and leave him be. Galadriel joins him on his raft when the rest are taken. Bronwyn tries to convince the villagers to leave because of what she has seen with Arondir, but Waldreg and the others refuse to believe her until she returns to the tavern with an orc's head, freshly won in combat inside her own house, and says that anyone who wishes to live should come with her to the watchtower the elves have abandoned. The next morning, she leads her community towards Os Tirith with her son, Theo, who takes with him the sword hilt that he found in Waldreg's barn. Even though he's discovered that blood is drawn to the hilt and flames into a blade.
Mm. Fighting a massive storm, Galadriel is swept over the edge of the raft tied to a rope. Halbrand follows the rope down underwater to find her and uses Finrod's dagger to cut her free from the rope and bring her back to the surface. Nori and Poppy bring firefly lanterns as they try to tell the stranger that they're going to have to leave. The stranger whispers to the fireflies and uses them to form a pattern. Nori understands that he's looking for a place where that constellation appears in the sky. But as they watch, the fireflies die, which is, I think, really troubling. Hmm. The stranger sinks to the ground, and they don't understand any of it.
Yeah, yeah. There's an awful lot presented here that is just completely baffling to all of us. And the concern for the fireflies again, very much reflecting of the Harfoots in the natural world. I mean, who would have thought of using a bunch of fireflies to make lanterns?
Great idea.
But clearly, they've never killed them in that process.
No. No, just caught them within something mm-hmm. so they can light their way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I envision them releasing them later. Back in Khazad-dûm, Prince Durin is convinced that despite the timing of his visit, Elrond does not know about their newly discovered ore. But his father, King Durin, does not believe the coincidence. There can be no trust between Hammer and Rock. Eventually, one or the other must surely break. Which harks back very nicely to the rite of seeking Tarag.
Mm-hmm.
Galadriel wakes from deep sleep to realize that their raft has been found by a large ship captained by somebody that she cannot see. She's too exhausted to do more than lie back down on the raft and sleep again.
And so ends episode 2.
Yes, yes. Lots of switching back and forth in this episode.
Yes. I think we're having to do that because we're having to see lots of different places and get to know lots of different people in these early episodes.
Yes, we're definitely setting up information at this point. I mean, this is the first time we've seen the dwarves.
Yes.
Right? But you can only introduce so many new cultures at once.
Oh, I think if they put everything into the first episode, it would have driven people crazy.
Yeah.
More than it did.
Yes, well, that's another story.
So, but how would we sum up the cultural information we receive from these rituals in the first episode then, Marilyn?
Well, again, study and contrasts. It's interesting to note that there are more rituals per episode in the earlier chapters or episodes than there are towards the end. And I really see this as a means of giving us these distinctive characteristics. We even see, although we haven't really talked much about Arondir yet, the difference between the Sylvan Elves and the Noldor Elves. You know, what are their concerns and how do they see the natural world? I really cannot imagine Arondir carving a memorial image of his captain into a living tree.
No.
I just don't see it. Mm. I just don't see it. So in these little details, outside of ritual too, it's very helpful to see that contrast and be able to understand some of the deeper threads that are going to be pulling along here.
Yeah, showing us these cultural mores is a really good shortcut to understanding these people, isn't it? So, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, I guess that does make sense that they would front load the earlier episodes with these sorts of things, so we get to know not just the characters, but who they are in terms of their own culture much more quickly.
And it helps us make more sense of things that seem utterly contrary to what we would do. I'm thinking now particularly the Harfoots, of course.
Yes.
But and yeah, fun stuff that we uncovered today about Celebrimbor, which didn't even involve any ritual at all. I mean, it almost seems as though elves are natural ritualists. I mean, when we think back to the first episode and the scene in which the Galadriel and her warriors receive the golden ticket.
Yes, the great ceremony.
And they're sent home. The great ceremony, yeah. And yet there are still similarities. We see them, each of the different cultures, dressing up specially for the ritual.
Mm.
So Durin with his magnificent cape and Galadriel and her warriors all in white. And later on we'll see the Harfoots doing similar things, although to my inexperienced eyes, you know, one type of grass is pretty much like another type of grass when you wind it in your hair, but they do something special because it's a special occasion. It's not everyday time.
Right.
It's set aside time. It's liminal time. It's sacred time if they have that concept.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think that's lovely putting it that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So that's it for this episode. Write in and let us know what you think. Any suggestions you might have for rituals to look at? Anything else you'd like to share with us? We welcome your feedback at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com or on the Lorehounds Discord server, where we have a special channel set up just for Rings and Rituals.
On the Lorehounds website, there is also a contact form and a voicemail feature. Look for the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We're aiming to publish 2 episodes a month, But if you follow any of the Lorehounds podcasts, you'll hear our advertisements and they'll let you know when the next episode is approaching.
Also, be sure to check out the other podcasts supported by the Barovian Broadcasting Network, such as Properly Howard Movie Review with Steve and Anthony, Wool Shift Dust with Alicia, and of course, John and David on the main Lorehounds podcast. Links for all of these are also in the show notes.
Our thanks to our recording engineer and editor, Bob, to David and John, our producers, and to John for arranging our theme music, as well as all the others who support us along the way.
Now, if you would like to support us and the podcast, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Subscribers will get access to ad-free versions of all the podcasts, as well as many other benefits.
Until next time, then, remember, with apologies to any Scottish listeners, a dog may bark at the moon, but it canna bring it down.
However, farewell for now.
Ja, hyvaiset. Farewell.